You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Eliza Blank, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here talking to you today.
So Eliza, you're the founder of The Sill. We were just joking around. How do you describe it? It's a company around the theme of plants. You are an e-commerce brand, you're a retail store. How do you describe The Sill?
It depends, as I mentioned, who I'm talking to. So I could tell you that we're the first digitally native, direct-to-consumer plant brand. And sometimes that will land with some people and sometimes it doesn't. If I'm at a cocktail party, I'll tell people that I own a plant shop and I'll leave it at that. But realistically, you know, The Sill is on a mission to really modernize not only the garden center, so the way in which commerce behaves in this industry, but also realistically, we're looking to actually change the way in which people interact with plants. And I think that's a larger mission that sometimes our customers don't necessarily even realize while they're interacting with us. But the reality is that our use of time these days has changed so dramatically that, you know, gardening is never going to ever be the same as it was for us, as it was for our parents. You know, my mother, who had 6 hours to spend on a Sunday to leisurely garden in her backyard, is realistically never going to be an activity that I do. And so, you know, The Sill is really on a mission to modernize all facets of what it means to be a gardener and then also buy plants.
And you have a big educational component to that as well. With your website has lots of good tutorials and guides and information, and Instagram seems to be a place where you're putting out a lot of inspiration and ideas and answering people's questions and that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah. We initially started through all these visual channels, which was fantastic because I think there's no question that our product category begs to be photographed and shared and celebrated in such a visual sense. But when it came down to it, what our customers really needed from us was not just the inspiration, but the education. So in fact, what we found is that there's already so many others effectively doing our job for us. And what I mean by that is that they're already marketing plants. You know, there's been such a huge surge of, you know, makers and designers and interior designers, all of whom are on these social channels sharing inspiration. So the intent to purchase plants is actually already being created for us. But what's getting in the way of our customers actually becoming plant parents is that education. And so that's really where The Sill has stepped in to say, you know, not only are we going to make this super easy for you in the sense that, you know, you can come to our website and purchase plants and have them delivered to your door, but we're actually going to prepare you with all the knowledge that you need to then have a positive reciprocal relationship with that plant. And it's not just going to end up in your trash can a week later.
Yeah. And you were mentioning gardening, but there's also, I mean, it seems like your focus is generally on house plants, right? Indoor plants. Or is that wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. So it has been focused on indoor plants. So, you know, as we think about, again, sort of change in behavior, especially with our generation, you know, Americans are spending 90% of their time indoors. You know, there's obviously been, you know, trends towards urbanization. People are living in cities. So when we just realistically think about how we spend our time, gardening in and of itself, too, has to change in the sense that we now encompass indoor gardening as much as outdoor, and sort of what does that mean and what does that look like? You know, our intent and vision for The Sill is to really be indoor and out and actually sort of break down the superficial barrier between what that means. So for instance, you know, being on the West Coast, really indoor and outdoor doesn't really have to mean anything different. Here in the Northeast, it does. But, you know, how can we educate people with about plants in a way that breaks down those barriers so that they feel as comfortable indoor, outdoor, or vice versa.
Yeah, and that's totally true in my life as well. We're recording over Skype, but I'm here at my place where I'm just surrounded with lots of houseplants in Los Angeles. But where I grew up in France, actually, I was right next to a forest. My mom is a huge gardener. She's got all kinds of fruits and vegetables and all kinds of things going on. But here in Los Angeles, We don't really have real forests. We don't really have, I live kind of in the downtown area. We don't have like great parks right nearby. I mean, Griffith Park is kind of like that. But I was missing a lot of the feeling of being near more green stuff. And a few years ago, when I was running my previous company, we were manufacturing fabric dye. And so there were a lot of chemicals in the air. And I wanted to make sure we had like some breathable air. So I started looking into plants. And one of the things that really got me on this like learning about houseplants was reading about the NASA Clean Air Study. And you're probably super familiar with that. But I think it's something that at least my geeky brain like really attached to. It was a study that maybe you want to describe that, because it's probably one of the things that people think about when they're thinking about plants is like, how can they bring clean air into their space?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a similar situation in that I grew up in, you know, a very rural part of Massachusetts. It really wasn't until I moved to New York City that I realized how much I actually loved plants. Plants had always been an afterthought because I just grew up in and around nature. It wasn't until I was out of that environment that it occurred to me how deeply impactful that it can be on your day-to-day, not just emotionally, but physically. So to your point about, you know, clean air and the NASA study, there is a reason why our planet is supposed to be covered in plants. And it's, you know, because we have this exchange with plants where they're feeding us oxygen. And in the meantime, they're also filtering out a lot of the nasty stuff that we as humans have now put into our air. And so whether it's, you know, to your point about chemical dyes or, you know, in my case, in fact, I just moved apartments and we bought a new couch and a new rug, and you can just smell the chemicals in the air. I mean, it's shocking actually to realize that it's these types of products that surround us day to day, including, you know, things as benign as paper products that are putting chemicals like formaldehyde in the air. And what's great about, you know, tropical houseplants is they can actually filter that out of our air and make it cleaner for us to breathe. And so, you know, whether you're coming at this from a home decor perspective or a health and wellness perspective, plants are still sort of the antidote for that. And that was part of the motivation for starting the business, is understanding that there's so much value add here with this product, you know, if you want to call it a product. You know, we don't really have to make up benefits. The benefits are baked in. And lucky for us too, we're all hardwired to want to be around plants. So it's not the hardest argument to make to someone who's new to plants as to why they should incorporate them into their lives.
Yeah, for those who are wondering about the clean air study, it was a thing, I think that NASA commissioned it in the 80s, and they were trying to figure out how could they have a like self-sustaining human colony in space that would regenerate the oxygen that was necessary for people to breathe in space. And the plants that they found were the best for that were also plants that were really good at filtering toxins and chemicals. If you look it up, there's a list of, I don't know, 20, 30 plants like ranked by their different properties. I don't remember exactly the statistic. One of them was like, if you put 8 large snake plants in like a cube and you could just like breathe that air like forever, you would never run out of oxygen or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the study pointed to two things. It's that, you know, plants filter the air chemically, right? So it's breaking down all those volatiles. They're obviously then providing us with oxygen when we exchange carbon dioxide. But what's actually one of the more interesting things that I always like to tell people that they don't necessarily consider is that the surface of a plant is actually charged opposite to dust. So dust clings to plants. And so it's actually physically cleaning the air by removing dust from it. So if you ever look at your houseplants and you're wondering why they're always so dusty, or if that's seemingly a reason why you don't like plants, you actually have to consider the fact that the reason why they're covered in dust is because they're actually pulling that out of the air that you breathe. One of the things that we also talk about as it relates to the NASA study is that a lot of people misinterpret it as the plants on the NASA list are the only plants that filter the air, which is not true, which is actually all plants filter the air, but they were able to test those and kind of rank them based on the different types of chemical compounds that they're able to break down. But it is true that all plants do this. And so, you know, we always like to talk about sort of the broader story of that, just how amazing plants are.
And I think that the educational point of what you're building is so important, because as I've like gone more and more into these areas and filled my place up with plants, I've become like the plant guy that people know. They're like, "Hey, what kind of plant should I get?" And I'm just like, "Go to the store." and but it's not just that. I think there's a lot of like aspirational plant ownership where like people, I've noticed a real fear that people have. And I liken it to other things like cooking or drawing where people are like, have decided at some point in their life, like, I can't draw, I can't cook, I kill all my plants. And this is like such a sad state of being to me. I'm like, no, you could do it. It's not that hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like oftentimes we're part coach, part therapist. You know, oftentimes the lessons that we impart on our customers, they sound so dramatic, like they can apply to every area of your life, right? So, but what we're really just trying to tell them is, you know, you don't know if you don't try, and it's okay to make mistakes. And there are some things that are out of control, and that's okay too. And, you know, if you fail, just try again. And that's a dialogue that we have about plants, but it does extend into other areas of people's lives. And I think actually that's why our generation seems to be taking so well to plants, because it feels like this manifestation of other things happening in their life that they really want to take control of or practice at or get better with. And it becomes sort of this living, moving meditation.
Where do you start? Because I think maybe that would be one of the hardest barriers to entry when people have such a, either they've never cared for plants, or they've had plants and they've died, and they're like, you know, my experience so far is I can't keep a plant alive. How do you start the conversation with them?
Right. Or restart the conversation rather.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that has to do with, again, how we approach plants and education, and to a certain extent, customer service. You know, we try and make the entire category feel much more approachable and directional, so that you're not left to your own devices to choose something based on what you think looks pretty. I mean, I think part of the issue is that oftentimes people will go into a garden center that's quite large, or even a Home Depot, and just choose something they think looks nice without having the conversation about it. Or even if they have a conversation about it, by the time they get home, they've already forgotten what they talked about. For us, we point people in very specific directions to say, you know, if you're new to plants, or if you've sort of failed in the past, try this specific plant. And we have, you know, 3 to 5 plants that we always like to point people to if they're beginners. And, you know, what's nice about that is, you know, they're guaranteed, they come with care instructions. You know, we're incredibly accessible as it relates to customer service. So you can DM us on Instagram, you can call us, you can text us, you can drop into one of our stores. There's really no reason why anyone should have a bad experience, even if they quote unquote fail, because they're learning along the way and they're having this really fantastic dialogue with my team and our brand, and will feel generally very positive about the experience, even if they manage to kill this next plant, which generally they don't, because we give them pretty foolproof things. But oftentimes what we hear is, oh, I can't even keep a cactus alive, or I can't even keep a succulent alive. And that's actually just really poor positioning on everyone else's part, because there's nothing that should suggest that keeping a cactus or a succulent alive is the most easy. Maybe if you're in LA where you are, where you have, you know, beautiful weather and sunny windowsills, but to keep a cactus or a succulent alive in the Northeast is near impossible. So sometimes it just requires sort of a rewiring of that outlook, that, you know, you can't just grab a cactus, stick it in a dark corner, and think that you're going to have success. Eventually, that's going to die because it's just not getting enough sunlight. So, you know, it all comes down to sort of a re-education around, you know, what do plants live off of? And we're able to present that in a way that doesn't make people feel like, you know, we're talking down to them, or that, you know, they should know this already. And we find so much joy in it too. It's, you know, we're kind of like your own Bill Nye, but for plants. So, you know, we all geek out about the science behind it, and we find customers really appreciate and find that to be fun for them too.
I want to work our way back to sort of the beginnings of the sill, but I just have a really basic question, because I haven't actually ordered from your website before.
Sure.
How do you ship a plant in the mail? That seems like a challenge.
Yes. Well, it's not entirely easy. But, you know, what people don't know, or at least our generation doesn't know, is that plants have been going through the mail for decades. So, you know, my grandmother, my mother would buy plants through mail order catalog. So it's not that it's entirely new, but of course, I think people's expectations about how they want their unboxing experience to be is changed and does present new challenges. So we do expect to have a really lovely experience unboxing our product. And especially if you're a new plant person, it feels less acceptable that you're going to open a box and have it filled with dirt, or, you know, not have it be feel like neat and clean and fun. So, you know, we've developed packaging and processes that allow us to keep the dirt packed in, that allow the plants to stay upright and the foliage protected. It's a hodgepodge of materials that we've sort of landed on that works best for our size and types of plants. But unfortunately, you know, we actually haven't even been able to crack the code on all plants, you know, so we still focus on plants not only that we know our customers are going to have success with, but that we know are going to travel really well.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, it seems like some of the leaves might be more fragile on different plants, and then you've got the dirt itself. Like, how do you hold it in place? I'm just very curious about how it actually works.
I often tell people that it's not unlike wrapping a gift basket. So the filler that we use isn't crinkle paper. It's actually like a wood pulp. So the wood pulp goes into the potting soil and packs that down so that the potting soil isn't going to spill out even if it gets flipped upside down. You put sort of a sleeve, like a tall sleeve, over the entirety of the plant so that the foliage is protected. And then it gets nestled into corrugate such that it doesn't shift around in transit. And then, you know, similar to, you know, most anything else that you would unbox, we have, you know, they call it void filler, but it's just like extra paper that kind of goes around and nestles everything into place. But when we developed the packaging for our product, we were almost exclusively just selling potted plants, and often being used sort of as like a self-purchase for gift or a gift for someone else. And so our basket size was really just, you know, the one item. So most people were originally shopping with the Sill to buy one thing at a time. The challenges that we're now facing is that people are buying like 12 things at a time, which is great for business. But then now, not only is that a challenge at scale, but also to figure out, to reconfigure our packaging needs to be more thoughtful, because you're now not just trying to protect one plant from, you know, the UPS guy. You're trying to then protect that one plant from the 10 other plants that are sharing the space with it inside the box. So we've definitely faced challenges at scale trying to figure out the best way to ship these products, but it's not impossible. You know, we run into issues like anyone else. I mean, I think that's true even with some of the most sophisticated companies shipping the most basic items. But, you know, if you can ship, you know, a flat screen TV across this country, or a goldfish for that matter, you can certainly ship a plant. And we've definitely had our fair share of ups and downs with it, but we've been improving for sure year over year and understanding sort of the seasonality of what we can ship as well.
Can you walk us through sort of the transition? Because e-commerce was not the first thing that you tried, if I'm correct. You were on Kickstarter, you have a couple retail stores now, And most recently, you've been launching your membership program. So it'd be great to hear a little bit about the major milestones in that transition.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Sill has been around for 6 years, which some people know and some people don't. To some people, that's no time at all. And some people, that's forever. We started in 2012, to your point, with a Kickstarter. And the Kickstarter actually did fund a website. It was e-commerce, but it was localized. So we were effectively a storefront without a storefront in the beginning. You could shop on the website, but only if you lived, you know, within a mile radius of me, because I was going to be potting your plant and delivering it to your front doorstep. And quite honestly, that's how the business worked for more than a year. I mean, for a significant chunk of our startup life, we were exclusively a local business in New York, but you would shop with us through our website. What was nice about those days is that it kept us very close to our customer. It did get us into e-com early. And, you know, quite honestly, it kept us honest in the sense that we were only growing if we were offering a product that people wanted, right? So we were bootstrapped for 5 years. We were only growing on revenue alone. It meant that product market fit wasn't a nice to have. It was a must have if we were going to exist at all. The first store that opened was really a risk. You know, we had been in business for some time. We were just getting ready to launch a nationwide shipping program. The reality is that a store was probably extra complexity that we didn't need at the time. But it was one of those moments where, you know, you kind of just go based on gut. So the whole reason why the store even opened was that a storefront near our office had opened up and become available. And our office is in Chinatown here in New York. So it wasn't like a super trendy neighborhood that was going to be like a home run by any means. It was like, here's a storefront that's available, that's close to us. And because that it's actually in a less desirable neighborhood, the rent's okay. And we decided ultimately just to take the risk and do it and know that, you know, it could be for pure, you know, marketing and tangible, you know, qualities, or it could be profitable. And we honestly, we just didn't even know what to expect, but we took the risk. And in fact, I worked in the store for like something like 6 weeks straight, like not even a day off, because we didn't even have anyone to staff the store. And the first year was interesting because we actually learned so much more and faster about our customer, because then all of a sudden our dialogue wasn't happening on sort of a transactional basis with people who were buying things on our website, but we're actually now having conversations with customers who are coming in, who are browsing, who are, you know, just thinking about purchasing something. But of course, if someone comes to your website and they're just thinking about it, you're never going to get that feedback. You really only get the feedback if they transact and check out. So for us, the first store actually really did lead to so many great insights that changed, you know, the very nature of the brand and therefore the online experience. And I would say that, you know, it was the store that really inspired the level of education that you see available from us today. From there, we did also launch our nationwide shipping program. So around the same time. And that's really when we started considering ourselves a nationally, you know, recognized brand. And you could see that with the takeoff of our Instagram and so forth. And then last year, which is, you know, 2017, we opted to actually raise a proper institutional venture capital to continue our trajectory of growth. And certainly that's helped impact where we are today. And we've opened our second store here in Manhattan and now intend to open more.
So when you went out to raise money, what was the pitch and what was the reaction? Because it's definitely, I think people would maybe not expect to see that in the venture community.
Well, you got that right. Yes. So, you know, I was nervous because here I was a solo female founder pitching plants. You know, that was not the most expected combination in the world of venture. And I would say it took me some time. It wasn't a home run. I didn't go out and raise and close around in a month. It took me nearly 6 months actually. But it was interesting because, you know, what we were able to speak to was the fact that we had grown this business quite organically and well. I mean, we'd surpassed $1 million in revenue on our own with effectively not a dime of outside investment. You know, to some investors, that was really compelling because, you know, here you have a team who is clearly mission-driven, is clearly passionate about the category, has figured something out, and has proven quite a bit. And so in some cases, it really worked in our favor. In other cases, it actually didn't because venture capitalists look for that hockey stick growth. For them to look at our, you know, 5-year P&L and say, well, you know, you haven't really grown all that much. We would expect to see much more growth or early adoption before investing in a company of your size. And so we had to sort of deal with that duality of finding someone, finding an investor who ultimately had the conviction and belief that, you know, we were able to become a category leader here based on the traction that we had built up. And I think, again, to sort of going back to, you know, how the business evolved, it's my strong belief that it took us 5 years to really understand, you know, what the insight really was to go out to investors and say, here's how we're going to build, you know, $100 million, $1 billion business. In the early days, you know, quite honestly, it was like, hey, this is a, you know, let's put plants online. That doesn't really exist. And it took us a couple years of really working with the consumer to understand who the consumer was to then say, actually, it's more than just plants online. And this is then to the extent why we're going to be able to build that giant business.
If you're willing to share, I'd be curious to know what are the things that made you want to pursue that path rather than continue, you know, growing organically. Were there certain investments you wanted to make where you just didn't have the cash? Like, what are the things that you were looking to be able to invest in that you couldn't do without that external investment?
Sure. No, of course. It was a couple of things. One, I think as I got deeper into the business and as sort of like the external environment was changing, so we were seeing plants become even more of a trend than what it was when the sale started. It was sort of a confluence of the external events that made me realize, okay, we're in this moment of time and we're quite lucky to have this business in this moment of time. Do we really want to pass up the opportunity to scale this business because we're hell-bent on bootstrapping? So part of it, I would say, was just strictly ambition. It was, here's a huge opportunity that we're sitting on that could be really, really big really quickly if we were to take outside capital. And then I think, you know, another piece of it was more tactical in the sense of there were things that we just simply wanted to do. So prior to bringing on outside capital, you know, our website, for instance, was homegrown. It was being worked on by the team who had, you know, bits and pieces of skills that could cobble together a site that was functional and maybe kind of looked like how we want it to look. But the reality was it didn't come close to demonstrating the true vision of the brand. And for me as the, you know, founder and CEO, that hurt, you know, day in and day out to say, you know, the biggest sort of demonstrable thing that we have, our website, our e-commerce platform, doesn't actually showcase what I believe the true ambition and value of this company is, was tough, but obviously a very heavy lift. So knowing that, you know, that was one of the first things that we wanted to sort of overhaul was part of the motivation for wanting to bring in outside capital. As a bootstrapped company, you know, even being profitable, you're never going to have large chunks of that kind of money to invest back into the business all at once. And that was what we were struggling with. The store at that point had become very profitable and beloved, even in the kind of tricky neighborhood that we were in. We're on, you know, if you're familiar with the city, we're on the corner of Hester and Allen Street. It's kind of no man's land. It's not some a natural place that people want, or, you know, end up shopping, for instance. But knowing how successful that store had become as well, you know, definitely also motivated us to want to open new stores. And that, again, becomes an expense that you just have to weigh, you know, do you want to redo the website or do you want to open another store? Knowing that we could do both with outside investment was meaningful. And in fact, that's exactly what we did. We relaunched the website and opened our second store both on the same day.
That's amazing. And the website is really beautiful. What was your approach to that from a creative standpoint? What were you looking for that the old website wasn't fulfilling?
Sure. So, I mean, it was a couple of things. I mean, realistically, we not only rebuilt the website for functionality, but we re-merchandised it from a strategic standpoint, and we actually redid our visual identity as a brand. So it was a huge overhaul. We worked with an agency here in the city called Wondersauce, who was tremendous and loved working with that team. But we actually brought in an external creative director who then reworked the visual identity of the brand. So new logo, new color palette, totally new expression, which I think really lent credibility to what we were doing and elevated us sort of out of this sort of quasi-maker DIY company. You know, we wanted to have a bigger presence and signal to our community that we were growing and that we were going to become a nationally recognized brand. And so it was important to me that it wasn't just a matter of making the site work a little bit nicer, but that it was more of an unveiling of, you know, here's the SIL 2.0. You know, this is kind of what the future has in store for us. So the website, you know, certainly from a UX perspective, does offer a much cleaner environment and experience for our customers. From a merchandising perspective, we, as I mentioned, we really changed the way that we merchandise the product. So it wasn't just exclusively pre-potted plants and pots, but you could buy the plants, you could buy the pots, you could buy accessories, you could shop by all these different categories. It is a complex or can be confusing category overall to shop. So then how do we make this solution oriented so people know that when they're going into the SIL, they can shop for low light plants or pet friendly plants or plants for beginners. And again, a lot of those insights came from the conversations we were having on the ground in the store. So really, you know, in a way, the website was, how do we take the best of the in-person shopping experience and make that available online to everyone who might not have the ability to walk into one of the SIL stores? And so it was kind of a combination of those, you know, three things, you know, user experience, merchandising, and creative that I think really came together quite nicely. Certainly met my expectations, and certainly we saw, you know, a considerable lift in business. So we know that that's been a good use of the money that we raised.
Yeah, how do you measure that? How do you measure the lift? I mean, obviously you can see the numbers, but what was it? Was there an additional marketing push as well, or was it just like from releasing that new update to the website, the conversion rate went way higher? Like, how were you able to actually measure that change?
Yeah, I mean, we measured it across all the KPIs that you would typically consider. So, you know, traffic was up, conversion was up, time spent on site was up, basket size increased, AOV increased, you know, kind of everything moving in the right direction. We certainly timed it right to get attention for it, in the sense that we did open the store at the same time. So typically, I think if someone re-releases a version of their site, it's not necessarily something to write home about. You know, it's not necessarily something that you're going to see in the news if a consumer website just simply gets a refresh. The fact that we also opened a store gave us an opportunity to speak about the new store, which is more newsworthy for many outlets, but then point back to the fact that we had relaunched our website. And the new store also then showcased the new brand identity. And so having those mirror each other and take place at the same time was, in retrospect, a really good strategy that worked out for us quite well. Part of it was just about project management. Of course, it was still a goal of ours, but we were able to pull that off from a timing perspective. And it also happened to be holiday, so it was December 1st that we did both of these things. So we were getting an inordinate amount of attention because of the store, because it was holiday. So we naturally end up in things like gift guides. And then we're sort of able to direct everyone's attention back to the site, which happens to be brand spanking new and offer all the things that we always wanted to offer our customers.
When you were describing the evolution of the company from, you know, a website where you are actually like hand delivering the things within a mile radius to where it is today and where you want to go in the future, the supply chain around that, actually like getting the plants, I'm assuming you're not growing the plants, you're buying them wholesale, and then is that how it works? Can you basically describe like how do plants get from like where they're grown to where they get to the customer?
So yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, as this business has evolved, our supply chain has had to evolve dramatically. So in the early days, when it was just a website and me, I was driving out to local nurseries, buying products, still wholesale, but a lot of the local nurseries, especially as it relates to houseplants, are middlemen, so to speak. So, you know, most of these tropical plants aren't necessarily being grown in New York and New Jersey. They're getting them from Florida, but they're selling them here as part of their garden center alongside their native plants that they might actually grow locally. So, picture me in a zip car driving out to a nursery, buying product to fulfill orders. That's kind of what it looked like in the beginning. Fast forward to 2018, we have a facility out in New Jersey. It's about 14,000 square feet. It's beautiful. It has, you know, basically floor-to-ceiling windows around at least two walls, almost three. And so it's operated like a greenhouse, but also like a pick-and-pack center. So we have horticulturalists on staff who take care of all the plants. And then we have a production team that's, you know, spends their entire day packing the plants up and shipping them out to fulfill orders. So at this point, we buy direct from the growers. So down in Florida is a lot of our supply chain, but our plants come from Florida. They come from California. We do work with some specialty growers in the Northeast who are growing specific types of plants closer to our location. But we have a procurement team who works very closely with our growers, understands, you know, who's producing the best batches of certain plants, understanding, you know, who's willing to commercialize certain varieties that we think are going to be cool and trendy. and just generally keeping their finger on the pulse of what's going down there. But we're getting plants on a weekly basis. I mean, our inventory turn is really, really quick. So even though we have a massive amount of space and we might sit on product like pots and potting soil and accessories, our plants turn so quick that we're getting, you know, the tractor trailers up from Florida every single week.
Wow.
Yeah, which is really exciting and really fun. And it does mean that our customers are getting product very quickly right from the growers. They land in the stores only a couple days later. There's not too much transit time or time sort of being held by us with the plants when it comes to the efficiency of our supply chain. So that's been a huge part of our growth, you know, is having to actually determine, you know, who's going to be handling and shipping our product. We could have easily tried to broker deals directly with growers to have them ship the product themselves. But we ultimately decided that if we wanted to take responsibility for the consumer experience, all of that product was going to have to come to us before it goes out to our customers.
Yeah, that was something I was wondering about. Like, I've heard that Florida is, you know, one of the main places where a lot of these plants are grown. And does it make sense to set up your, you know, distribution there, or is it just not that convenient because you want to be able to have the quality control or other parts of your process be happening near your office or something like that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, we've actually considered having a facility ourselves down in Florida for that very reason. But the reality is, this is how product moves across the entire country. So from a quality perspective or even a timing perspective, if you're in, you know, Michigan, for example, and you're buying a tropical houseplant, that still took the same journey to that garden center as it did to get to us, because the origination of the supply chain is generally in Florida. Florida also obviously has its own challenges just in terms of weather and storms and whatnot. So having a facility down in Florida comes with its own risks. But so far it's worked quite well for us, and the product really gets to us, you know, within only a couple of days. And then we're able to feed into our two storefronts and ship out from a easier location, I should say, to the rest of the country.
Yeah. And when I think about how people buy plants today, you know, you mentioned Home Depot before, which is, I mean, plants is like, I'm not sure how big of a percentage of what they do it is, but it's probably single digits, I'm guessing. It's not like they're a hardware store. They have plants also, you know, they have soil, they have all these other things in the garden area. You're so focused on this one segment that even nurseries or florists or whatever other places you could think of that have plants are not nearly as focused as you are on this subsection of the market. But it seems like the part that is the quickest growing or makes the most sense for the modern urban consumer in particular. I'm just curious why someone hasn't come up with this before. Is it just that the trend has picked up a lot lately, or is there something else that has caused the industry as a whole to not see this opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Quite honestly, I think it's generational. Again, sort of all of these external factors coming together just at the right time. Certainly plants are not, you know, plants have been around, you know, plants predate human existence. So we can just start yeah. there, right? It's not like yeah. this is new. And it's not even to say that the still is trying to reinvent the plant. You know, we're not hybridizing right. plants. We're not growing plants. We're not tech enabling plants. But what we were able to tap into is the fact that, generationally speaking, we're looking at a younger generation who seeks a totally different experience than prior generations as it relates to how they spend their money, who they spend their money with, how they spend their time. And I'm not even just talking about the authenticity of the transaction, but even beyond that, you know, we have a generation that's more concerned with things like sustainability and the backstory behind their product. I think plants naturally fit in with this generation because of interest in new sectors like health and wellness and self-care, but then also home decor as a form of self-expression. And I think it has a lot to do with social media as well. So, you know, the SIL's been around since 2012. I can look back on my own personal Instagram account, and it's about the same time that I started using that channel personally. As I mentioned sort of earlier in our conversation, the intent to purchase has been drummed up by other channels. You know, we're not even having to necessarily push marketing on people because they're actually already being inspired by all of this other media that they're consuming. So, you know, I think it's an interesting moment in time, you know, especially also more people living in cities, as I mentioned, more people spending their time indoors, and more people also feeling like they need something real to focus their time and attention on when they're otherwise focusing all their time and attention to a screen of some sort, whether it's their phone or computer or they're just, you know, at work. And I think it's for all these reasons that this particular generation, the millennial generation, has become so intrigued, I should say, by plants, but then they're also the most removed naturally from plants because, you know, we also just didn't grow up in a way where gardening and taking care of plants was part of our sort of like everyday life. You know, I think back to my mother, and I don't know how she knows so much about plants. It's like magic. And to me, it was like, it must just be intuitive. And it's, you either have it or you don't. But again, we always fall back on this idea that, you know, this is a learned, practiced hobby. You know, you have to learn about it. You have to spend time doing it. It isn't just something that you're innately good at or not good at. And we're also a generation of information seekers. So I think, you know, the fact that we're able to then organize and communicate this information in a way that is compelling to a generation who wants to learn is sort of a first. You know, this is a very, very old industry. You know, it goes back hundreds of years. You know, the first horticultural society, you know, was from turn of the century, you know, in the 1900s. And it hasn't changed all that much since then. So how do we sort of reinvent this category for this generation in the most compelling way possible? That's always been the question for the SIL. Why someone hasn't done it sooner, I just honestly think it's been a matter of timing.
It was fascinating to think about, you know, you're thinking about plants as a product, and you've mentioned that word several times, and it's something that you don't really control. It's a thing, as you mentioned, that's been around for a while. But there is a part of the product line that you sell that you do control, which is sort of the accessories and the things around it. The pots in particular seem to have gone through its own evolution as like a part of the business. Maybe walk through that part as well.
Yeah, well, we always figured, you know, part of the issue was to, you know, 10 years ago, your shopping process was itself was super fragmented. So, you know, I'm going to go to a garden center to buy plants, but then I'm going to go to a home goods store to buy the pots if I want them to look anything, you know, like the rest of my furniture. And then, you know, if you need potting soil, maybe that's a Home Depot. Maybe you can get it at the garden center. But the reality is both of those oftentimes are geared towards a contractor. So like, you know, I don't know if you know what 3 cubic feet looks like, but it's a lot. And that's the way that potting soil is bagged. All of these things felt very disconnected. And that's just from the commerce perspective. Then when you talk about education, it's like, well, if I then want to learn about plants, am I going online to a blog? Am I watching HGTV? You know, am I calling my mother? And then talk about wanting to connect with other people who like plants. You know, am I going to a horticultural society? Like, is there a club? Is there a community garden? These things were all just so disconnected for so long. And, you know, the SIL's approach has always been, how do we create a single platform, a single point of destination, a single point of discovery for all of these things? And what that meant then was, we're not just going to sell plants. We're going to be considerate and sell you all the things that you would then need to be a plant owner. And that includes pots. And the pots, you know, for us needed to be appealing from, you know, aesthetic point of view of, you know, this is going to be in your home. And, you know, why shouldn't the container that your plant is in be as beautiful as, you know, any other artistic object in your house? And what was shocking to me in the beginning of the business was, you know, you can go online, you can find like 1,000 different shower curtains, you can find like 1,000 different throw pillows. Like, why wasn't that true for containers for plants? You know, you had terracotta, cheesy stuff that was, you'd find like in the Christmas tree shop. And that was kind of it. So for us, it would just seem like a no-brainer. And so we early on got into designing and creating our own ceramic planters as well, thinking, you know, you really can't have one without the other. And why make someone, you know, go to another destination for that product? We want all of that interaction to be with us, and then continue to extend that through creating product around education and creating product around community, and really wanting to be, a, as I mentioned, sort of that singular destination for all things plants. And that was not easy either. I mean, we started working with artisans in the beginning who were hand-making all of our pots. We eventually found a few manufacturing facilities to work with. And now we work with very, very large manufacturing facilities, some of which are here, some of which are overseas, in order to continue to build on our product line. But I think, again, it's something that adds tremendous value to our customers, knowing that the product was really created and intended for the plants that they're buying. And that's also been a disconnect, is that oftentimes, you know, someone who's creating a plant pot doesn't know anything about plants. So, you know, for us, it's, you know, what is the correct size? You know, does, how does it drain? You know, how long can a plant, you know, sustain itself in a pot of this size before needing to upgrade? And then is there a size available, you know, the next size up that still has the same design and aesthetic? So we've been thinking about the whole process very, you know, 360 degrees, really since the beginning. It was always sort of baked into our plan and our ambition.
Yeah. And just a couple of months ago, you launched the membership model as well.
Yes. So the membership is a fantastic new thing that we're doing, again, building on the insights that we've developed in store. So originally, we still do this, we offer workshops in our stores. So you can come in, it's a ticketed event, you can learn about a particular plant, or you can learn a particular skill like how to repot your plant. And we were hosting these workshops frequently, and they were frequently selling out. Part of the reason is that we can only fit, you know, 10 people comfortably in either of our stores. But of course, we didn't want to limit ourselves. So from that experience, we then ultimately put workshops online, and we made it a digital product where you could still purchase a ticket. It's still a ticketed event. You could go and, you know, attend a workshop with one of our plant experts. And what that meant is you were actually going to be watching a workshop live online, kind of like a webinar. And we had instant success with that. That, you know, immediately resonated with people who couldn't get to a store or wanted a more short form workshop. And then the natural progression from having online workshops was to create a membership program, knowing that we always wanted to get into creating community, more community around this category, which has naturally always had community around the category, but has felt very antiquated. So, you know, again, your horticultural societies don't really have much to offer a 25-year-old. So the membership program then launched in June, and it offers unlimited access to our online workshops. It offers free shipping across our site with no limitations, and then a surprise gift a month from a sales greenhouse team. And that could be anything from an accessory to a plant itself. And we've had just tremendous success building the membership program, even with only, you know, about a month and a half under our belt.
A lot of our interviews here on Well Made are with people who are based in New York and who are building e-commerce businesses that have a lot of similarities, even though they're in completely different industries. We've talked to people who are doing dog food, people who are doing baby clothes. Like, they're all different things. And I guess, what are you seeing out there that you're pulling inspiration from? Who are the other entrepreneurs or companies that you look to when you're thinking about the sill?
Mm-hmm. We think about loyalty, evangelism, community as being the goal here. We believe in order, you know, to get big and to do that efficiently without just throwing, you know, ad dollars around, it really needs to come from within. It needs to be that not only are we delivering an exceptional product that people love, but that they want to talk about, that they want to share, that they want to experience over and over and over again, and bring their networks of people to share in that same experience. So, you know, we look at brands who are doing this really well, whether it's, you know, Glossier in the skincare and cosmetics industry, or Lively, which is a women's underwear line. There's just a tremendous amount of evangelism and brand loyalty that has never truly existed. I mean, you can talk about, you know, people who prefer Coke over Pepsi, but this is a totally different era, I think, when it comes to consumers' participation in brand and what that really means for the network effect. And so as we look to companies and brands that inspire us outside of our own industry, you know, we're sort of taking this very outside approach to, you know, gardening. I mean, gardening really is never thought, has, as you mentioned, has never been thought of as like a product category or an industry, certainly not as a direct-to-consumer industry in the way in which we talk about it today. And so how do we borrow strategies that we've seen work really, really well in other D2C categories into this category for the first time?
Well, thank you for all your insights. I really recommend that people check out, at the very least, the Instagram, because I've been following it for a couple of years now, and it's I think Instagram has me pinned now as a plant person, so it's like suggesting a lot of plant related content. It's great. I don't mind. It's very soothing and relaxing compared to most of what's happening in the rest of my social networks. So I really enjoy that, and it's really fun. And I think, as we mentioned at the very beginning, it's something that people should try, and it's very rewarding as a hobby, and it makes places more beautiful and more fun to be in. So,
and it makes people happy.
Yeah, as your slogan goes. So if anyone wants to check out The Sill, also thesill.com, is there anything else you want to point people to?
I would just say, you know, keep following us. We have a lot of new fun things happening in the near, not too distant future. So if you haven't found the right thing for you yet, not to worry. There's more coming from us.
I know that Caitlin, our podcast producer, is a big fan of your Instagram Live series, where you have like an hour-long conversation, or I guess like Q&A with an expert on your team. Who's basically just answering questions. Is that right?
Yes, we pick different topics every week. I mean, again, really speaks to sort of the foundation of our educational programs. But it's tremendous. I mean, every week on Wednesday afternoon, Chris Satch, our head of plant science, hosts an Insta Live. And without fail, he gets at least 1,000 people watching him for a full hour on, you know, on anything plant related. It's really phenomenal.
Thank you so much, Eliza. This was great.
Well, great. I really appreciate it too. And I hope everybody has felt a little bit more inspired to incorporate plants into their life, whether it's from us or otherwise.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.